Service today, cloudy and mild, the high is 70, 55 degrees overnight. Looking ahead, the weekend looks fabulous. Saturday, partly sunny and 68. Sunday, partly sunny and 69. Here are the new numbers just in. Wind from the north at 6, humidity 84%. Still a good cloud cover. 65 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Coming up on 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I feel so privileged to be sitting opposite the new provost and chief academic officer at Carthage College, Dr. David Timmerman. And Dr. Timmerman has only been on the job for a few weeks. He actually assumed the post on the 1st of August. And typically we would let somebody sort of settle into the position a bit before bringing them on to the morning show. But here he is. It just worked out nicely, and I couldn't be more pleased. We're going to be talking with Dr. Timmerman about his long career in higher education and also kind of the circuitous route that he has taken into higher education. His is a slightly unconventional story and a wonderful story, and we will be talking with him about that and also about his initial impressions of Carthage and the kind of challenges that a institution like Carthage is facing in this current climate and what he hopes is ahead for Carthage in the years and decades ahead. Dr. David Timmerman, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. It's so good to be here. And thank you for using the word unconventional. My family, my wife and my two sons often tease me for being so regular and predictable. And so when you say unconventional, I'm going to say that you said that to them, and that's going to help me feel less predictable to them. So thank you very much for that.
Very good. Yeah, I certainly didn't want to use a word like weird or bizarre. It doesn't quite qualify as that, but that's one of the things I most appreciate about your story is it isn't sort of the straight path that is sometimes the case. I suppose it's the closer we look at life's paths, the less predictable they in fact are. Since we've already kind of brushed up against that, maybe that's where we should begin. Why don't you tell our listeners, first of all, where you are from originally and what life's sort of initial trajectory appeared to be for you?
Yes, thank you. Born and raised in Alhambra, California, which is one of the many, many cities in the L.A. area. It's just a couple cities to the east of Los Angeles, very close to the city of East Los Angeles, actually. So born and raised there, had a wonderful family growing up, and felt very loved and encouraged and supported. Something I'd wish for every human being. I had that. Initially, I went to UCLA for college, and I was on a path to get I did get an undergraduate degree in psychology. I was also very involved in a church there during that college experience, and I also met my wife of now 35 years, Polly, at that church. So it was a wonderful, productive time for me in that way. And I was on a path to go into ministry. The first path I was headed toward was toward Christian counseling with that undergraduate degree in psychology. I went into a master's program in counseling at Denver Seminary, and that's what the first move away from California was, that step to Denver. Interestingly, for a long time, I know both Polly and I thought we would end up back in California. And as you can see, now some many years later, that hasn't happened as of yet. But so that was the initial path, was into Christian counseling, and I was really about 75% of the way through that program. I was in my clinical experience. I was 6 months into my clinical experience working under the supervision of a psychologist and counseling when sort of one of those things happened where you just say, you know, I'm not sure this is actually the right path for me. I'm not really sure that I actually enjoy this the way I thought I would. And I'm thankful for that experience. You know, I think for a lot of young people, those are great experiences. That's why internships are so important. That's why trying things, even shadowing individuals in professions is so important, because I had a light bulb go off and I realized, you know what, this actually isn't really what I want to do. And that's so important. You know,
right.
It could have taken me 10 years to get to that point.
Right.
I'm glad it only took me a year and a half.
Right. And it, of course, takes a little bit of courage to sort of face up to that reality, and that's not courage that people always find in those moments, but or they don't want to admit that they've embarked on a path that in fact wasn't quite the right path for them. And just to reiterate, this was some kind of a counseling situation,
yes.
And that's what didn't feel right to you.
Yes, absolutely. I was doing various. I was doing actually, I was doing premarital counseling, and I was doing individual adult counseling. And, when I think about it, it wasn't the experiences with those individuals, but it was the debriefing and conversations about the experience that I had with this psychiatrist who was supervising me, who was very helpful. And it was sort of, maybe he was kind of doing counseling with me in a certain sort of way, but he helped me come by the questions he asked and different things. He helped me come to that realization. Now, what that led to was a continuation at the seminary and moving into pastoral degree. So I did stay at the seminary. I added a year to my program. I like to say I squeezed a three-year program into 4 years. but I ended up getting the ministry degree, the MDiv, and then going into full-time Christian ministry, which actually I enjoyed a great deal. And it was better. I was better suited to that. I was finding more enjoyment and fulfillment out of it. And it was a happenstance that got me off of that path.
Right. And I think that happenstance somehow occurred at Wabash College. Right. Am I remembering that right?
No, the first happenstance that happened happened at a community college, Arapahoe Community College. What took place was that I got a call from probably the provost. I don't remember actually the individual who called me, but a dean or a provost from Arapahoe Community College. And what had happened is they had had someone teaching courses such as Bible as Literature, Old Testament, New Testament. And the person who had been teaching it, I guess, for more than a decade, all of a sudden one day was not able to. I don't remember the details of what happened, but I do remember that just one Thursday morning I got a call from an individual at Arapahoe Community College, an administrator, who said, we've had this individual teaching this course for about 10 years. They can no longer do it. Another session of it starts Tuesday night. This is like the next Tuesday night, 4 days later or whatever. Would you be interested? And I think the only reason the person called me is that our church was right on the main, on the highway to Arapahoe Community College. The person must have driven by the church many times. And so that was the first, and it was really totally, completely out of the blue. And I spoke with some of the leadership of the church, and my thought was, actually, I think I'm kind of interested in this, and actually could be a good way to get the church's name out. It might help bring people to the church.
Sure.
And say, well, as long as you continue your other duties, sure. So I scrambled, got a course together, at least the first night of the course, and showed up Tuesday night, and had a fantastic experience. It's an interesting one. I guess you're interested in hearing it because you called me in here, Greg.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, so an interesting thing happened. So it's a Bible as Literature course. We're starting the class, and I asked everybody to just introduce themselves, and what was it about the title and the content of the class that interested them? And that's just a way, you know, as a teacher, you're always trying to figure out, you know, where are the students in terms of their knowledge, and where are they in terms of their interest, and see how you can go in that direction, okay? And so different people stood up and introduced themselves, and then a very interesting couple introduced themselves, a tall, elderly, distinguished-looking man stood up and said, I forget his name, but he said, no, my name is whatever it was, and he said, and I just want to make it clear, my wife and I are Wiccans, and we're coming to study the Bible from that perspective.
Wow.
And then his wife stood up and said, you know, said her name. And you know what? That turned out to be one of the best classes I've ever taught. Of course, I've taught hundreds of classes now at this point in my career, I would say a couple hundred classes probably. And but that was so fascinating because they were very open about it. Where they were coming from, it's actually, they were model students in the following way. They understood a good bit about what they believed and what they knew, and they were able to articulate it in a very, in a very clear way, and they were able to hear the views of others and different perspectives and respect those. And so the conversations in that class, really because of their, I'll call it leadership, were so fascinating because the contrast, when you can have people with differing views, explain them in a clear way and not in a way that denigrate someone else's views, and then you can have a respectful conversation about it. It was so rich. I think everybody in that class enjoyed every minute, every night, and that hooked me on teaching. And I think there's a way in which I've been trying to recreate that kind of classroom environment ever since.
Wow, the recreate the magic that you experienced that first time. That's terrific. And so, how long did that juggling act go on between the parish you were serving as a pastor and this teaching assignment?
Yeah, well, Greg, you're right. It was a juggling act. You're insightful. It was, and it took about, I think I want to say it was about 3 years, but it was probably two. After about two of doing that, I started to sense this shift in my, what I was really interested in doing, and I began looking into PhD programs. What would that mean? And I first looked at programs where I could continue being a pastor, and I remember a conversation I had with Polly, my wife. In fact, we were on a long trip. We were on a 17-mile drive, not all in one day, but like over 2 days, or 17-hour drive. We had to drive 17 hours over 2 days to get up to see my grandmother in Prince Edward Island, Canada. And so somewhere in that 17-hour drive when our oldest son was asleep in the back, and he was about, I think he was like two or so at this time, she finally said, you know, if we kind of came to this place where it's like, I could do this part-time and it would take 7 or 8 years, or we could do it full-time and it would take 4 years. And she said, let's do it in 4 years. I don't want to suffer. So that's what made the shift. Yeah. And so in 1990, we moved from Denver to Indiana, and I began a PhD program at Purdue University. And then a next step would be Wabash, which is that as I was completing my degree at Purdue, I was teaching at a community college, Indiana University Kokomo. But I had an opportunity to interview for a one-year position at Wabash, and I did so and was offered a one-year position. It was a little bit risky. I had, at that point, two small children. But there was something about Wabash. There was something about just the sense I got of being on that campus, even for just a day, that caused me to say, wow, there's something really special. There's something really unique there. This small residential liberal arts college, the kind of community and the character and the sense of itself that I picked up from the faculty and the students that I interacted with. It was sort of like maybe going to Disneyland for 2 hours and saying, oh my gosh, there was something way, or Disney World, or, you know, something way different about that. I want to go there for 2 days now. I want to come back, right? You know, 2 hours at Disneyland, that's kind of, you know, it would just really, and I kind of had that kind of experience. I need to see more. And so obviously conversation with Polly, we decided to take a little bit of a risk going to a one-year position. And I can remember, I've said this many times, then two, three, 4 weeks in, I remember walking across the campus there at Wabash one day after having taught a number of 2 or 3 weeks of classes and getting to know the students a little bit more. And I just had this, like, another light bulb go on, and I just said to myself, this is exactly where I want to be. And that's such a great feeling. Again, I think back on young men and women today, and Carthage students, Gateway students, everybody else. I want that for everybody. I want everybody to find themselves, even if it takes several steps, in a career where they really get that deep sense of, this is exactly where I want to be. This fits who I am. I see how I can contribute to it and make it stronger. I'm gonna enjoy, maybe not every moment of every day, but I'm gonna enjoy going into work every day. And wow, this is wonderful. You know, wouldn't it be great if, you know, we need to just keep working so that that happens for more and more people.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today with Dr. David Timmerman, who is the new Provost and Chief Academic Officer at Carthage College. We are getting to know him today for the very first time. He only assumed the positions of provost and chief academic officer on the 1st of August, so really still brand new to the job at Carthage. And we are finding out about the path that he took into the world of higher education. So how many years were you at Wabash College?
I was at Wabash College for 16 years, from 1994 to 2010.
Primarily as a teacher?
Primarily as a teacher, then a department chair for about 10 of those years, and then a division chair for several years. So I did begin taking on administrative responsibilities pretty early on, I think in my third year. And then just sort of move through those different positions.
Right. I sometimes think this is very true of people who go into the ministry after doing something else. Our senior pastor at my church was actually a counselor for many, many years and then felt the call to move into parish ministry. And I think of others I've known in my life who also did something first and then did this other thing. And to a person, they all appreciate the fact that the path they took was sort of a winding one, and they felt like when they arrived at that final destination, they were, in a sense, a little bit richer than if they had just taken the elevator straight up the shaft. And I suspect, but correct me if I'm wrong, but I suspect that you probably felt the same way as you began teaching, that it was okay that you didn't just sail up the shaft that straight and narrow path, but took this bumpier route.
Absolutely, and that's why those changes that young people and all of us make at various points in our lives, which can feel scary, and can feel like, well, darn, I'm not using my degree in psychology. That actually, even that sentence, there's a falsity to it, right? So I have an undergraduate degree in psychology. I use what I learned in that every day. And
I'm using it right now, probably.
I'm using it right now. And so you're right. I think coming to a different career at various points in our lives, having gone through a circuitous path, all of that is accrued information, knowledge, experience that you then bring to that role that probably others don't. And that makes you richer in that role. It makes whatever organization, nonprofit, for-profit, company, whatever, better, because you're bringing all that diversity of experience to that new role. And so, yes, I think you're exactly right.
Hmm. How would Wabash compare with Carthage? Is it a school of comparable size and comparable approach? You already mentioned that it's a small liberal arts school, so at least at that brief description, it sounds like a place comparable to Carthage.
It is, in many, many ways, and in more ways than not, it's very comparable to Carthage. And again, going back to that residential liberal arts, what it's seeking for students and what it provides to students, very similar. The holistic experience, the classroom experience with a broad education, along with the depth in a major, but then the co-curricular experience all across the campus in terms of student organizations, fine arts experiences, athletics, all of those things, very similar. There are some differences, some interesting differences, actually. The first one would probably be size. Carthage is a next size up from Wabash College. But the most interesting and curious one is that Wabash College remains one of just three schools that still has an all-male student body.
Oh.
So sitting here in 2018, there's still quite a number of all-women's colleges, mm-hmm. Or women's colleges. But there's really just three all-male student body colleges, and Wabash is one of those. So that would be, if you just walked on both campuses, that would be the one that would you'd notice pretty quickly.
I should think. So what was it that prompted your departure from Wabash to assume a position at Monmouth? Because I think that's where you have been most recently before Carthage.
Yes. The link, what moved me from Wabash College to Monmouth College was an initial conversation with Maury Ditzler, who had been the dean at Wabash College during a pretty pretty significant time. During my time there, I'd gone up for tenure, and it sounds like I'm bragging, but I'd won the teaching award during a time when he was there. and we had become friends. I was a division chair. I was a department chair at that time, and he was the dean. And so obviously we had a lot of interaction, and we kind of developed a friendship. And in 2006, he moved to Monmouth College to become the president there. Mm-hmm. And so he was president. I remained at Wabash, and I didn't anticipate anything would be different. To be honest, I thought I'd be at Wabash my entire career. But I did get an email from him long about 2010, where he said, would you be willing to speak with me over the phone about the dean's position here at Monmouth? And then it was just sort of one thing led to another. Well, would you be willing to have another conversation with me? Yes. Would you be willing to come and visit the campus? And then, well, what would you think of getting in the pool for this position? And so, you know, one thing kind of led to another. And over time, just in conversations with Polly, that opportunity started to sound more and more interesting to take that next step in a leadership position. And so and then I was fortunate enough to be offered it in the summer of 2010. And so that's when there were some other things going on. My youngest son was also graduating from high school in 2010, and he, without ever having heard the word Monmouth, he made a decision to go to Illinois Wesleyan, which we were supporting. You know, we were going to support him wherever he chose to go. By then it became a situation where if we moved to Monmouth, we'd actually be closer to him. So that played a role. And so then happily, we all moved from our home of, you know, 20 years, West Lafayette, at about the same time. My oldest son was actually in the Middle East at that time, So that's what got us to Monmouth College. And so, yes, I was there from 2010 to 2018, served under two presidents. Again, small residential liberal arts college. Really enjoyed the great faculty there, great staff, you know. So these colleges, they draw people on the staff and the faculty who care deeply about students. And you just see that. I just, now that having seen that at three different places, I recognize it. And there's one thing to say is that I think people who get into those roles, everybody sees themselves, and they are educators. So right down to the person, you know, in the facility staff, you know, working on the grounds or facilities issues or the dining service, right? All of those individuals because of the culture that's already there before they arrive, but they can begin to see, you know, I'm part of this educational enterprise. When the student comes into the business office upset about their bill, this is a teaching moment. And so it's a beautiful place to work because it creates this culture among the faculty and the staff that's it's a shared enterprise. We're all actually doing the same thing. Every moment here, every day, is an educational opportunity. And so it's a wonderful place to work. So Monmouth was also a wonderful place to work. Not to say there weren't challenges. There are challenges at every school, especially these days, but there's a shared vision among the faculty and staff that makes it a great place to work.
You, of course, were assuming different responsibilities at Monmouth. You weren't dean at Wabash.
No.
Although you'd been department chair and so on, and but this was a different kind of responsibility. How did that responsibility feel? How easily or comfortably did it rest on your shoulders?
Very interesting question. So what would I say about that? I think I developed comfort with it over time. I'm probably going to call on sometimes we get our best sense of ourselves by seeing how other people are reacting to us and what they're saying. And so probably, Greg, what I'd say is I'll recall what Polly said about those times, which is that I looked like a deer with the headlights in their eyes for, you know, a year or two. I think that's probably the most accurate reaction I can remember, that my mind was just always spinning things in it about the role, and it took me a long time for the gears all to mesh. All right, and so because there's a lot to learn just about the facts and details of the college, the course enrollments, the majors, all of that. There's the whole budget side of everything, and then there's the strategic initiatives that you're seeking as an institution that you're trying to help faculty and staff get attached to. And so there's a number of different major aspects of the role, and it's sort of like they all actually have to happen all at the same time. And there's no way for the institution to say, okay, everybody, we have a new dean, we have a new provost, so remember, we're all going to put pause on all the things we normally do that have to happen at this time of year until the new provost or dean figures things out, and then we'll push play again.
Right.
No, it's all going, you know, and so you're stepping onto a moving conveyor belt, and you got to just figure it out somehow. And what it takes is faculty, staff, the people you're working with, kind of quickly developing trust, and then working on to grow and build that trust. And so that's what I recall at Monmouth. That's what I'm experiencing already at Carthage. Is I found a number of people that I've already developed a trust relationship with, and that's a big part of it, because you cannot do these roles on your own. There's a way in which these roles actually are. You're actually, in a certain sort of way, you're not actually doing much. What you're actually doing is coordinating and helping other people do what actually needs to be done. And so if you stand back and you say, well, what did you do at Monmouth College as a dean for 8 years? There's a way in which I could say, you know what, I didn't do a darn thing, okay? Let me tell you what other people did. Let me tell you what the faculty did. Right. Let me tell you, yeah.
And how I helped make that possible.
Yes, how I helped make that possible, yeah.
We're speaking with Dr. David Timmerman. He is the provost and chief academic officer at Carthage College as of the 1st of August. So tell us how that connection was made. I mean, if I may be so bold to ask, were you looking for a new position about the time that this came open at Carthage, or did it sort of fall out of the sky as an unexpected opportunity?
Yeah, good. Thank you. Yes, I was looking for a next opportunity. At Monmouth, we had a new president in 2014. And I wanted to be sure to, I think it's a responsibility of someone in a role like the dean or the provost, if possible, to help with a transition so that there's a smooth. And so I did that for the first couple of years of President Clarence Wyatt's time there. And I had open conversations with him about looking for a next opportunity. And so I began to do that a couple of years into his presidency. And so, but I was always very selective, because actually I really enjoyed Monmouth and was happy there. But I had began looking for particular, schools that I thought might be of interest and applying. Selectively I applied over like the last couple of years. And then when you do that, then it's sort of, well, what happens once you do that? And of course, a number of them didn't pan out. This one, there's a staged process for how you hire a provost or a dean that's pretty, standard. It starts with an airport interview for some percentage, so I don't know, however many people applied for the Carthage position, there were probably, and I don't actually know the number, but 8 or 10 typically were invited to an airport interview, and so I was invited to that.
And we should explain to listeners who don't understand, you're talking literally about an interview that happens at an airport.
Yes.
I mean,
not on the runway.
Right. Yeah, probably not. That would be a bad sign. A very much a neutral, kind of generic setting in which typically the search committee will meet with kind of an array of different candidates that they're very seriously interested in.
Yes, and there's a kind of a sleuth part of it, so a lot of these search firms run it as confidentially as possible, so they're actually really dictating, we want you to come into this part of the lobby, we're going to take you up this elevator, when you're done you're going to go to this other elevator, you're going to go down, right, and we don't want you hanging out in the lobby, we want to keep this confidential. It's sort of, you almost feel like Maxwell Smart and Get Smart, the way it's going, but
not talking in your phone, but everything else.
Yeah, or my shoe phone. talking my shoe phone. But when that happens, when you're invited to that stage, then you really start digging deeper into the school, okay? Because before that, it really doesn't make sort of practical sense to spend too much time researching a school. I mean, you do enough to say, yeah, that's not something I'd be interested in enough to apply for. But then when you take that step, and so then, I mean, what happened to me with Carthage was I began falling more and more in love with the school. right? The more I read, the more I saw, and, you know, I watched YouTube videos, you know, Carthage College YouTube videos. You're looking at all the things on the web that you can see. They send you material, so you're looking at those. I'm a junkie for some of the public information that's out there on colleges, which might be interesting to your listeners or not, but there are I-990 forms that are publicly available for every institution in the country. There's information that's on a national data collection site called IPED. So you just start looking into this, and you're doing all this research, and the more I did, the more I liked. And then, of course, there's that moment. You go to the interview, and they're interviewing you. There's, I don't know, 7 to 10 people interviewing each candidate. But of course, there's a way in which you're interviewing them, right? Mm. Because you're getting cues from them as to, so what is this place like? What are these individuals like? What is the culture like there? And I had a really good experience with that search committee, and a number of the individuals are actually the individuals that I'm now, I mentioned that trust, hopefully growing trust relationship with some of those same individuals. And so I had a really good experience there. So then I leave that, and I'm thinking, well, I hope this goes a step further. And of course, obviously it did. And so then you have a on-campus interview. Mm-hmm. And again, the same thing is going on. Different groups on the college, on the campus are interviewing you, but there's a way in which you're interviewing them because you're trying to get a greater sense. And so each step of the way, and it's kind of like dating. I guess you start with Tinder. Tinder is the application process. What I don't really know about Tinder, but I've heard of it. But so each step, you know, I felt better and better on each step, more and more comfortable, more and more excited. And so then I was very, very happy to receive a call with the offer.
Very good. I assume, I mean, I remember from the emails that would come from the search committee, a representative from the search committee kind of chronicling the progress, I mean, letting the rest of the faculty know at various points along the way. So I know a couple of the names of people who were part of that search committee.
Okay. Right. I thought you meant the candidates. Okay.
Yeah, no, the search committee. Okay. And I was just wondering, I am assuming that a search committee like that is really comprised of what amounts to kind of a representative swath of what the college is and the various departments and so on. And yes. I should think that would be really crucial to a search process like this being worthwhile and effective.
Absolutely. So there were representatives from the Board of Trustees, representatives from different arms of the college, admissions, student affairs. Mm. There was, I'm trying to think, the other person, the campus pastor, Pastor Cara Baylor was on the committee. So, and all of that's important too, right? So it actually was very happy to see the campus chaplain on the search committee. That was a big plus for me. I was happy to see a Board of Trustee member. So, yes, and that gives the candidate a greater understanding of the institution. It also signals that this is a role that is not just about working with the faculty. This is an institutional role, and the best way it can be enacted is someone with that understanding.
Hmm. So let's talk about the role and the fact that, first of all, you, at least on the surface, play two roles at Carthage, that of provost and chief academic officer. And it would be great if you could sort of untie those terms for us. And maybe while you're at it, let's also talk about what a dean does, because, mm-hmm. of course, once upon a time, Carthage had somebody who was a dean in roughly the same role as you, and now we have multiple deans in sort of a different level of the pyramid, so to speak.
Yes.
And a provost. Unlock for us sort of the distinction between those terms, and particularly between the two terms that you are handling at Carthage as provost and chief academic officer.
Mm-hmm. So some would say, well, Greg, it's mere administrative inflation, right? And inflation on the national economy has been low for a number of years, but oh boy, at the administrative level of colleges, inflation is still running rampant. So maybe some people would think that, but really, it's at the most basic level, it's a matter of size and what. So you're more likely, the roles of dean and provost actually are very, very, very similar. You know, they're kind of a Venn diagram. Think of the two circles being pretty well overlapped. But once an institution starts raising, increasing in size, the ability of one person to play that role, it becomes more and more and more difficult. So certainly when you get to the size of Carthage, and institutions would be moving to a provost situation, probably, you know, even 1,000 students smaller than Carthage. But certainly when you get to the size of Carthage, you are going to have this provost and dean situation. I just don't think you could scour the country, 4,000 colleges and universities in the United States today. If you find one of Carthage's size that doesn't have a provost instead of a dean, I'll buy you lunch at a burger place. But no, I'm just kidding. it would be very, very difficult. And yeah. So it's really about what any one individual can do. And so. And actually, I wouldn't make too much distinction between provost and chief academic officer. They're really signaling the same thing. I think it's just a different. It's a way of saying if you could have a dean that's the chief academic officer, you can have a provost that's the chief academic officer. The title's getting at the same thing. So what Carthage has is three deans. We have three divisions, natural and social sciences, arts and humanities, and professional studies. And so we have a dean that is over each of those areas. And their faculties are the size of many, the faculty that they oversee are the size of many liberal arts colleges. I mean, sort of this, what would I say, the traditional size of a residential liberal arts college still remains at about 1,000 to 1,500. So if you just, again, it's like churches, you know, most churches in the United States are, you know, 100 to 200. You know, we have mega churches now. We have all different sizes. It's true, but it's still to this day, 2018, it's still like more than 70% of the churches in the United States are 100 to 200. Or 75 to 150, something like that. And so... So what the provost role is about is serving at the cabinet level at Carthage. It's the executive staff, working with vice presidents across all the other divisions, but then also working with the three deans and actually several associate provosts. And Carthage is not unique. We have several. We have three at this time anyway, three associate provosts. That's not unique. That's fairly similar to, again, because of the size of the institution and the administrative work that is needed to support that academic enterprise. So it's doing those two things. The one way of putting it is something like the provost is the rope that on one side is being pulled by, say, the board of trustees, the president, and pulled in one direction, and then on the other side is the faculty and everybody else pulling the other direction. And I'm just trying to stay limber enough so that I don't get split in two at some point.
Well, we certainly would hate to see that happen, especially after just a month on the job. So we hope, if that happens, we hope that's a long way off in the future. So what would be, in a sense... the most vexing kind of decisions or choices that you as provost have to make? Mm-hmm. I mean, what are the sort of knottiest knots to untie, maybe the most difficult choices that you need to be making? Maybe pointing towards that thing you were saying first about how so much of what you do is about enabling other people to accomplish what they set out to do, but... it can't be easy to decide what is possible and what is appropriate for the college.
Yep. So two things come immediately to mind. One and then a caveat. So it's probably the case that what you might anticipate to be quite a number of decision-making points that a provost might have, you know, you might imagine that number of decisions to be rather large. The truth is it's not actually that many quote-unquote decision points where it's A or B or A, B, C, D, or E. So it's not quite like that. But in terms of vexing, so I'm going to just focus more, less on the like this decision part, if you don't mind, Greg, and more on that, what the most vexing parts, because I like that word and it's accurate to the experience. There are vexing parts of it. The two things that come immediately to mind, at least sitting here today, would be it's really vexing when you get into specific difficulties with faculty in departments, or just working with each other, or sometimes in the review process. So, you know, it's, we work together. We have a shared vision, but there are different manners of operating that, that individuals can have. People get themselves into positions and are maybe are struggling how to be effective in those positions, and then you just have conflict. You have conflict between people. It happens, and it happens everywhere, and it happens on a liberal arts campus, and it happens among faculty. And so when you get in the middle of that, and this is where sometimes it does call back to that counseling background and that pastoral background, but it's nevertheless, you know, you can see people suffering. They're suffering because they're struggling to work productively with others. They're struggling in their interactions with each other. And sometimes they just have to be working together because they're in the same department, because they're doing the same initiative or whatever. And so to see people who are struggling in their interactions with others, or struggling in their work and suffering to a degree, even if they're angry and frustrated, they're still suffering, that's vexing, because there's not often a real easy, oh well, I can just come in here and turn this little knob 2 degrees to the right and everything will be okay, right? No. All right, so that would be one. Another is colleges today, it's a complex and difficult environment for all the reasons we know. Demographics, the ability of families to support their sons and daughters for a private education, education period, actually any school, private or public, the ability of families to support their sons and daughters in pursuing higher education has been reduced in this country, particularly in the last decade. So it's a more difficult environment than it's been before, demographically, economically. And the needs of society are changing so greatly. I know just in our region here, in southeastern Wisconsin, you know, there's great need for developing the workforce. But the particulars of that are changing all the time. Mm-hmm. And so being able to meet that challenge, it's difficult. And so what I would say is vexing about that is bringing faculty ideas, faculty initiatives, faculty innovations, and all of which cannot be pursued. I mean, one of the great things about being on a college campus is faculty are incredibly smart people, all right, and they have a lot of good ideas. But, of course, the institution doesn't have the bandwidth nor the resources to pursue all of them. So which of the many good ideas that faculty have out there should we shepherd forward, and how and where are they going to match the needs of this region, but the nation and the world, right? And again, you know, look at the world, look at our world. The challenges out there are incredible. Hunger, the environment, on and on it goes. So how do we bring those together? And that's vexing because all of the elements are changing so rapidly. And you're trying to meet them up. It's sort of, I don't know what sort of visual image I'm creating in my mind, but it's just a lot of things are spinning, and you're just trying to figure out how would they best fit together, and which one at which time. So there's a lot of good faculty ideas, but maybe it's not time for this, this, and this, but it is time for this, this, and this. But how do you bring that all together? And of course, you have the different elements of faculty governance process. You have a institutional budgeting process. You have all these things, other things. So it's a lot of people. I know I had an image of liberal arts colleges quite a bit ago, probably when I was starting at Wabash. It's like, oh, this is just kind of a sleepy liberal arts college, right? It's been here for over 100 years, and you know, things that, you know, everything. No, wow, you look behind that curtain, and there is a lot going on. There's a lot of complex things all needing to work together and match up in ways that are not always obvious.
Right, and not always easy to maintain or sustain, especially in this changing landscape that you were just talking about. We have just a couple minutes left, but I want to be sure to give you a chance to say a little bit about what gives you reason to be so hopeful and to feel so good about Carthage, the place where you are now, to maybe speak to why Carthage is managing to flourish at a time when many, many colleges like it are struggling. Some of them struggling terribly, some of them winking out of existence altogether. Yes. And not that everything is perfectly rosy at Carthage. It faces its own challenges, certainly, but the school is flourishing at the moment. So let's finish on an optimistic and positive note with what strikes you as maybe the most significant reasons to be hopeful and optimistic about Carthage's future and happy about its present.
Yes, very good. Thank you. Things that I've learned, actually one of the things I learned early on that still fascinates me and I hope to learn more about was, a very, very formative moment in the college's, a long history, which was when Kenosha called Carthage College in Carthage, Illinois, which actually is not too far from where I was for those years at Monmouth, not too far. And I actually remember my wife's sister lives in Kansas City. We would drive. It was possible for us to take a couple turns and drive past the remains of the Carthage College, Illinois, on our way to visit Polly's sister in Kansas City and her family. And so I've driven by those buildings, and it's a you can't help but go, wow. But Kenosha reached out and said, hey, why don't you come up here? And they decided to do that. So somebody just picked that college up, and then what a beautiful thing. They dropped it right next to this big blue thing. And that's a wonderful kind of fantastical moment in the college's history. And so what was that moment? That was a moment when the college decided that its best future was to respond to a particular city and its people and a region and try to come up and be a strong part of that region. And it has done so. And so it can do it again. So to me, one of the great things about Carthage is there is a moment that predates nearly everybody on the campus. There actually are some individuals that have really interesting connections to Carthage College in Carthage, Illinois. But really, for the most part, right, most of us, including me, we're new to this, but we know that that our predecessors at Carthage College had the courage to do something really dramatic that easily could have failed, but it didn't. And so there's a lesson there, which is we need to continue to be about the task of responding to the needs of the community around us, the state around us, the country around us, and the world around us. And so we already know how to do this. And so that's one thing that gives me great optimism and hope. And the other would just be, as is typical at these colleges and what I love about working at them, it's the people that are there. So I would just start naming, and now we'd have to have another 45-minute interview. We'd probably have to have a 4-hour and 50-minute interview for me to name all the people that are there that have great skills, great preparation, great energy, and great commitment to the institution. And that's what makes these places run and makes them magical.
Hmm. Well, we are certainly happy that you are part of the mix now at Carthage. I speak on behalf of many of my faculty colleagues who I know feel very good about you being a part of Carthage and what you have done and said already. And we look forward to more conversations like this on the morning show. And in the meantime, appreciate you making time for this and what I know is a very busy schedule, especially at the outset of a new school year. I thank you so much for being part of the morning show, and we welcome you again to Carthage.
Thank you very much, Greg. It's been a lot of fun.
Dr. David Timmerman, Provost and Chief Academic Officer at Carthage. I'm Gregory Berg. Monday on the morning show, I look forward to a visit with Dr. Peggy James and Dr. Christopher Hutzbeth from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. They're going to be participating in the first of a series of noontime brown bag lunch discussions at Parkside, and this first one on the topic of smart cities. On Tuesday, I'm very excited to welcome to the program for the first time Dr. Robert Dukoff, who is the provost at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, so essentially Dr. Timmerman's counterpart at Parkside. And we will talk not only about Parkside and what's going on there at the outset of a new school year, but also talk about a special initiative which Dr. Dukoff is participating in, which involves a statewide initiative to try to help more and more students successfully complete college. We will be talking about some of the issues that are preventing some students from successfully completing college and what is being done to help that situation. On Wednesday, Sahida Hafiz, the author of a touching memoir called The Healing, One Woman's Journey from Poverty to Inner Riches. On Thursday, Nan Calvert pays her monthly visit to the program, and with her will be Matthew Collins, director of Kenosha County Parks. We'll be talking with him in particular about the Pike River Restoration Project. And on Friday, 1 week from today, Melinda Mamer Lowry, she has written a book about the fascinating history of the Lumbee tribe, the largest Native American tribe east of the Mississippi, and what it has been like for them to live in America, especially through the era of civil rights.